Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Klink.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's a Need to Know podcast. All thanks to the CIA Ops patron community. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, N2K Podcast, and online at ciaops.podbean.com.
Welcome along to the Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and you join me for episode 258. We're into November 2020, not long before we see December, Christmas, and then hopefully a much better outlook when it comes to 2021. So he's hoping that everybody listening is staying safe and that business obviously is keeping you occupied, and always wish everybody the best out there. And again, let us look forward to some of the opportunities that technology is going to provide us. Now, thank goodness that Microsoft is continuing to roll out plenty of announcements. One of the first ones that I noted was this new productivity score. So if you're familiar with the secure score, the security rating of a tenant, Microsoft has now given us the productivity score. So the productivity score looks at interactions with the services, with devices, and the user experience side of things. So there's quite a lot of information that is being pulled in here. Put the links in the show notes so you can have a bit of a deep dive. That should be available in your tenant now. Go and have a look. It does provide some really, really good adoption information to help you obviously roll this out effectively across your environment. So again, productivity score from Microsoft is now available inside your tenant. So go and take a moment, have a look, and see what it's all about and see what benefits it can provide your environment. Now, the next thing is that Microsoft has announced that it has reached 115 million daily active users of Microsoft Teams. So this is an enormous amount of people using this on a daily basis, and this continues to obviously grow very quickly given our current work from home environment. It's an indication how quickly the product has been adopted and how well it is now being integrated into many businesses. And it's important to remember that you should really be thinking of Teams as a operating system rather than, you know, something as simple as a video conferencing or a file access or something like that. So again, it's certainly becoming much more than that. It's becoming a platform on which, you know, things like file access, SharePoint, Surface, OneDrive for Business, and third-party apps as well. So the article here from Microsoft will give you some idea of, you know, some of the businesses that are using it, how they're using it, and as well as the projected growth that Microsoft is going to expect to see as Teams gets rolled further and further out into the environment. Now, it wouldn't be a podcast if we didn't mention something around security. There's a really good article that I commend for you to read about Microsoft talking about the attacks that were targeting an international conference and the analysis of that and what was required to obviously go in and solve that. So it's a really good article to read. Got some really interesting links there as well. And again, it talks about how this attack was discovered by Microsoft's Threat Intelligence Center and what steps were taken to mitigate that. Now, if you do want more information of general interest around security, not necessarily Microsoft, I'd recommend a podcast called Darknet Diaries. It's fairly light, but it is worthwhile to see the impact that some of these attacks are having, you know, right around the world, and some of the deeper dives into, you know, who's responsible for this sort of stuff and the threats that are faced out there. So again, they probably come out once every 2 to 3 weeks. Recommended. I'm a listener, so I recommend that as well. I'll make sure that the link is in the show notes so you can pull that up and go and have a listen yourself. But I certainly recommend that you do subscribe to Darknet Diaries and listen to it along the way to get an idea of what the actual environment is like out there. Now, speaking of security podcasts, Microsoft has released a couple of late. The first one here is called Security Unlocked. This is a dedicated security podcast. So it says here that it is designed to explore the technology and people powering Microsoft security solutions. There's not a huge amount of episodes out yet, so you can jump on the bandwagon early, have a listen to that one again from Microsoft. Another one from Microsoft is called Uncovering Hidden Risks. Okay, so the idea here is that this podcast will focus on the broader set of podcasts focused on identifying the various risks organizations face as they navigate the internal and external requirements they must comply with. So again, not too many episodes there for you to sink your teeth into, but I'd suggest you get on the train now and start listening to those, because I think there'll be a lot of good information coming along. One of the good ways, obviously, that we can again make most effective use of our time these days is to dive into podcasts. And again, I thank you very much for listening and taking the time to be part of this podcast. Now, another announcement from Microsoft is that it is planning to establish a couple of new data regions. The first of these is in Austria, so one for the European Union area. And again, put a link in the cloud in the notes there, so you can go and have a look as well. Obviously, driven by the growth in that area and also the population there. So I look to see that again to roll out relatively shortly. We've also got an announcement from Microsoft that it's looking to establish a data center in Taiwan, so one on the eastern side of the globe there. And again, it shows you that the demand for these sort of services continues to ramp up as well. And don't forget, a recent announcement a little while back was there is one coming for New Zealand as well. So lots and lots of investment that Microsoft is making in infrastructure in Azure and all those sort of services to make them available to more users. Now, obviously, they wouldn't be doing this unless they are making good money. And there is a nice little article here that talks about Microsoft's recent results, talking about how Azure's up about 48% and giving you some numbers there. So Microsoft's hitting revenue probably around the 36 odd billion US dollar mark per quarter. That's pretty good. They're looking at double-digit growth figures again, around the 20% on average. Some interesting figures to go in and analyze, but again, it reinforces Microsoft's bet, I suppose you could call it, or move into the cloud when it did. It's now beginning to reap some major benefits from that, getting people on subscriptions and growth in the outsourcing of technology into places like Azure as well for businesses, both big and small. Now, a really, really, I think, beneficial addition to Exchange Online that was announced is the ability now to use plus addressing. Now, what that means is that when you subscribe to a newsletter, an email, or a site, you'll be able to, for example, use the prefix and then put a plus symbol and put whatever you want after it. So a lot of people use this. What they do is they have their normal email address, then they put a plus at the front there, and then put the site that's going to. So if it was me, it'd be director plus site.com at CIAOps.com. So what that means is that you can create sort of throwaway email addresses that will be sent back to your inbox. It also allows you to easily distinguish and apply rules to those, and it helps you to identify when emails come from that location, both good and bad. So let's say that you set up plus addressing and a site gets breached, and that content or those login credentials then are used to send spam or to, again, target for attacks. You can then easily identify that because you've put the plus string in there to identify that. So if you haven't, go and have a look at the article I put in the show notes. At the moment, it requires a one-line of PowerShell to implement. Not particularly difficult, but it basically is, at this stage, a PowerShell requirement. I've certainly done that on my tenants and starting to use it as well. So it's a good way, again, to use throwaway style email addresses without, you know, too much reconfiguration of your current environment. So again, that's plus addresses are now available for Exchange Online. Now, there's also a good article here from Microsoft around talking about password spray attacks. So the way a password spray attack is basically a brute force attempt to guess the password for a number of user accounts. This is a very common attack that we see out there. People can automate this and hopefully come across a password of a user in your environment. Now, Microsoft has improved its capability of detecting this. The article here talks about the technologies that are in place and how this is going to help users. I would suggest that one of the best ways to minimize any potential threat from password spray attacks is to look to remove basic or legacy authentication, because that's typically what it uses. But again, it's worthwhile reading this article to get a better handle on, you know, what a password spray attack is, what it looks like, and again, the steps that Microsoft are taking to minimize the risk of, you know, this sort of very, very common attack. Now, of course, the other thing that we've seen recently is a Windows 10 October 2020 update. So again, not a particularly big update. It doesn't take that long to download. I think it's referred to as the 20H2 version. All my Surface machines now have that update. Took a little while for it to actually flow down after release, but it's now on machines and working well, no issues on my end. You can obviously go in and force that using the Windows 10 Update Advisor if you really want to, but generally the best advice is to wait until Microsoft offers it to you in the updates area. So if you haven't got that, go in and check to see whether that update is available and then start rolling it out basically to all the machines there. So lots of news as always, but I do want to get into the interview for this episode. I think it's a good one. Recommend that you again look at all the options and all the resources I'll make available in the show notes for you, the links that I've mentioned here as well. Remember that if you do want to make contact with me, you can do so on the Twitter at DirectorCIA, or send me an email, director@ciaops.com. And a good place to keep in touch with all the things that I'm sharing is my blog, which is blog.ciaops.com. But with that, I think we should get into this episode's interview. So welcome along to our interview for the Need to Know podcast. I'm joined by David Berman Burr from Microsoft. How are you, David?
Very good, Robert. How are you?
Excellent. Well, as promised, I'm going to get David to correctly pronounce his surname for everybody, because I mismatch it around, and also get David to just give us a bit of an idea of what his current role is at Microsoft and how he sort of got to that position over his career.
Excellent. So my surname is Berman Burr. The J sounds a bit like a Y. I'm a security architect at Microsoft, and I spend most of my time thinking about, concerning myself with, and attempting to help partners who help small and medium customers, which we define as those with less than 300 employees.
Cool. All right. So I would assume that you're probably very busy at the moment, because security is now becoming very much top of mind. With the move to the cloud, more and more people are in a situation where they have to really consider, you know, cybersecurity and protection in much greater depth than they ever have before. You know, from your point of view over the past period of time, is this the case? And do you see it's going to, you know, continue to accelerate? Is this, you know, something that has to be as important perhaps as the productivity side?
Absolutely. You know, what we're seeing is that the cyber criminals are getting much more sophisticated. You know, gone are the days where, you know, security is an annoyance. You know, people send sketchy emails that are easily identifiable. This more just mischief. You know, now the cyber criminals are quite sophisticated, and they're taking real money that is putting businesses at serious risk. One of our studies showed that 50% of SMBs are hacked every year. That means if you were not hacked this year, I have bad news for next year.
So it looks as though the bad news continues for 2020 and maybe into 2021, like everything else at the moment. So obviously Microsoft's focus now has really begun to solidify, I think, around the security offerings, and Microsoft 365 Business Premium is a really, really good example of that. The way that that product has matured and added in security features of late. But perhaps what we can do is maybe start off with letting people know out there, you know, what are the sort of security features that a product like Microsoft 365 Business Premium includes that many people aren't aware of or aren't generally implementing? You know, what are some really good features in there that people are not taking advantage of, even though they probably have it as part of their license?
Yeah, very good. You know, I think if you haven't heard the message on MFA and getting that turned on, you know, I think that's the one everybody does know about and hopefully has considered and started their journey if they haven't finished already. But the piece I think that people don't give enough attention to, they may have heard about it, but I don't think most partners and customers are fully enabling this, is Intune. Intune gives the customer the ability to manage the devices or the apps that connect to company data. And I think this is the one area that needs more focus. It's not terribly difficult to get started, but it does take a little bit of effort. And so I've been heavily encouraging the partners that I work with to, you know, get some experience in rolling devices in Intune, getting apps under management, which puts the company back in control of things like, you know, who has access to the email for their company. You know, if I look back 5 years ago, most small businesses would hope and pray that a departing employee would not use email they had downloaded previously inappropriately or files they had, but they had to trust the integrity of the departing employee. Features like Intune and mobile app management, mobile device management, puts the company back in control. It's also one of the very first steps for implementing any sort of serious cybersecurity defense, in my opinion, once we get past the identity piece with MFA.
Okay, so just a quick clarification, if I can, is how does the Intune piece, which is the more traditional service that has been around a very long time, fit together with what we're hearing about Endpoint Manager? I think there is some confusion around, you know, is Intune the same? Is it different? Is it integrated? So from your point of view, where do you see, you know, Intune and Endpoint Manager? What's your narrative to help people understand, you know, those two services?
I think the easiest way that I like to explain it is to kind of go back to Active Directory. You know, as a consultant, I spent a good portion of my career, probably 20 years or more, working with systems and customers and partners, et cetera, you know, setting up endpoint management in terms of Active Directory, where, you know, we wouldn't even consider letting people use computers in a workgroup mode, for example. So the way I see Intune is really Active Directory in the cloud. You know, it's a bit of an analogy, but it removes the need to have this difficult to manage, centralized, you know, on-premise infrastructure, but move that capability to a cloud infrastructure that functions very well no matter where the endpoints are, functions very well when users are remote or working from home, and provides many of the same capabilities of managing devices, managing the security settings, keeping an inventory, and blocking unauthorized access that a traditional on-premises Active Directory would, that, you know, 20 years ago, where, you know, when we went to the office and worked inside the firewall, would have used.
Okay, so obviously these are tools that are out there. Many people who have Microsoft 365 Business Premium will have that capability in their environment. And I think it is very straightforward to implement. There are wizards that will ease the process in. I think the recommendation I would have is that you should invest your time understanding the policies underneath. There are a lot in there. So we've got compliance, configuration, endpoint policies and so on. And they really can lock down the environment as well. So again, I think I agree with you that is something that is overlooked and people think that it's too hard. And I suppose the way I talk about it to people who are familiar with on-premise, it lies very similar to the concept of, you know, group policy to, you know, obviously secure environment. Now, obviously that with security being such an important concept across the board now, you were speaking about the importance from your point of view of a framework, a public framework that's out there. Do you want to sort of, you know, speak to the benefits you see of following, you know, that sort of public framework that is out there and let people know, you know, which specific one you're talking about?
Yep. So I'm a big fan of cybersecurity frameworks, such as NIST CSF or CIS controls. And I don't intend to endorse any one because I think they're very compatible with each other and generally apply the same thing. But the reason I like a framework is it helps customers and partners rationalize their decisions. They literally tell folks what to do. So I want to make a clear distinction here. A cybersecurity framework is relatively easy to implement. It doesn't take, you know, that much time or effort when compared to, say, like a cybersecurity program or, you know, a risk assessment matrix. You know, a control framework pretty much spells out exactly what you should do. And no matter which vendor, you know, if you're using major vendors like Microsoft or Cisco or, you know, whatever, we all actually give you very prescriptive guidance. And so this is a very approachable, straightforward way to get a handle on cybersecurity that's very well known, it's very highly respected. So when I think of the partner, you know, if you adopt CIS controls, say implementation group one, if you talk to any other cybersecurity professional, whether it's your customer or another partner, they're gonna understand first what you're talking about. Second, you know, every vendor has their own recommendations, but it can be get a bit cacophonous when you have Microsoft telling you one thing and another vendor telling you another thing. And I think it can get very confusing for folks to understand exactly what is being pitched to them. So what I really like about a framework is it helps folks rationalize their decisions. They can, you know, if they're talking about, you know, let's say spam and phishing protection, right? They can figure out, okay, exactly where in the framework that plays, what products it competes with, and then they can decide for themselves if the pitch they're hearing is really applicable to their current problem set, you know, prioritize it effectively. So I think adopting a framework is a little bit of work on the front end, but the benefits pay off over the long term, and it really helps folks get a, you know, a really good handle on what they're doing. And you know, one of the partners I work with, or I've been working with this last year, you know, had a great soundbite that I just loved. You know, he said, you know, David, there's a lot of ways to do this CIS stuff. M365 Business Premium is the only way we found to get it done for under $30 a month. And what I liked about that, you know, when I thought about that, I'm like, you know, you're right. There's a lot of ways to do this. I could spend, you know, hundreds of dollars per user with all kinds of stuff. But then, you know, I really have to question, am I being effective? Do I have the expertise to run all these different platforms, et cetera, et cetera?
All right. So I will point out that there are obviously frameworks that are US-based. As you've mentioned, there are also some here in Australia as well. So if you are looking for some local equivalents, they are out there. You can certainly take advantage of all the ones that are out there, look at them and find the one that works for you. Can you maybe give us a specific example of, you know, where a single feature or a single option in Intune or whatever maps to, you know, an existing control in one of these examples you've got? So, you know, like a low level, you know, this actually maps to this. Are you able to do that off the top of your head?
Sure. And by the way, Robert, I'd love to hear what's applicable in Australia if you care to share. But to answer your question, if I think about the CIS control framework, you know, there's 20 controls that they recommend. And there, it's logical and recommended to implement the controls in order 1 through 20. So the very first control is to establish an inventory and control of hardware assets, which is really two things. Have an inventory of the devices that connect to your system, whichever that system may be, and limit access to your data to those systems, right? So that is, you know, if you think about what that would take in an M365 Business Premium case, that requires, number one, that you enroll the devices into Intune, step one. And then step two would be to implement some type of control to block devices that are not enrolled from accessing critical data. And that's very simple and easy to do. You know, the enrollment piece is just a few clicks. There's several recommended ways to do it. I have a blog that we'll share with you guys on exactly how to do it. And then the second piece of that is to simply implement a conditional access policy that requires a compliant device. At its most basic, a compliant device is an enrolled device. So just with a little bit of effort, a little bit of testing, can have the first control solved, which then leads into the second control, which is get a, you know, inventory control of your software assets or the applications used by your employees.
Yeah, I think that's a good step. A lot of people do, especially resellers, tend to overlook that cataloging, the documentation side of it, which is very important in security. So a lot of people would say, look, I'm really good at security. I know the ins and the outs. And my response is, well, show me a checklist. You know, if you are good at security, you will have a checklist, which will mean that you can repeat the deployments and you aren't missing obvious steps in that. And that is very easy to do, I think, in the security side as well. So again, working against the framework is a great place to do it. And as mentioned, there are US-based ones, there are ones in Australia. So in Australia, you can go to cyber.gov.au. That's the Cybersecurity Centre for Australia, put out by the government. Lots of really good options in there and information. I'll put the link in the show notes afterwards. So A little bit of pushback perhaps on the frameworks that are out there that I have seen. Do you feel that they can be implemented effectively even with, you know, businesses that may only have, you know, one, two or a handful of employees? I've seen pushback around the fact, well, we need to be a much larger organization to do this side of implementation. Is it something in your experience that, you know, a one person reseller operation can implement for their customers?
So I do think it can be, especially when we consider a simple framework, you know, like CIS. It's very approachable. There's nothing in there that I've seen that is too arduous for even a small implementer to take care of. And then I also look at, you know, what is the risk? You know, if you're a one person consulting shop and your customer that's relying on you has a security breach because, you know, perhaps you overlooked something. I think the problem is the same, whether you're a small operator or a large operator. Now, I will say there are lots of things you can do. Not every customer needs all the controls turned on, right? And a big part of all these frameworks is, you know, really to have someone to sit down and kind of think through all the things that are recommended and make their own decisions. I've seen many different firms and partners and customers, you know, make different decisions to solve the same control. And I think if they've, you know, sorted out for themselves what makes sense for their organization, they're very much a step ahead of the curve. Because quite honestly, you know, when we look at, you know, when customers are hacked, you know, and you know, of course, we have tons of data at Microsoft that shows, you know, the most basic security implementation would have saved most customers from most of the calamity that they suffered. The Verizon data breach report, you know, also confirms this. They actually specifically mapped to CIS to show, you know, if someone had mapped to CIS, you know, who would have been protected and who wouldn't. And that also showed that, the you know, almost all of the 4,000 breaches they studied would have been fully mitigated or mostly mitigated if folks had just done the most rudimentary security pieces. And then in my experience, a lot of firms, you know, do some of this stuff, but for various reasons, it's not complete. You know, for example, we often see that folks get our message about turning MFA on for users, but then, you know, if a breach happened, we go investigate, we find that, you know, one or two accounts, perhaps a service account or backup account, number one has, you know, elevated permissions, and then number two, for, you know, simplicity or ease of setup, they had not implemented, you know, a proper control around that thing, with MFA or something else.
And I think a lot of resellers may not appreciate that being obviously organized and having a good security approach is really the capability to stand out from the crowd now, to really go to customers with a very enticing opportunity. And that's obviously going to help the customers and provide them a service they need, plus generate revenue for the reseller that they may not be getting now. So I think a lot of people, especially resellers, seem to see that as a secondary thing. It's not a major revenue generating opportunity. They look at, you know, fixing keyboards and whatever, closing service tickets, and not perhaps looking at the bigger picture when it comes to security and the benefits it can provide to customers. I certainly agree it can be a harder sell, but I think the right messaging and the approach and the professionalism around it is a big seller, and it is becoming obviously more, there's more awareness in the market for the requirement to this. So I see it, you know, as much a opportunity for revenue for resellers to go out there and provide these needed services to customers. I mean, is that sort of, you know, mirrored in what you're seeing?
Absolutely. You know, when I talk to partners, you know, the ones that have some maturity in this space, you know, have found their profitability and the stickiness of their service go up. You know, and it does take some maturity to sell and deliver on these services around security. You know, but the thing that's notable is once they have, you know, the security acumen in place, they're not only able to consistently sell their services at a higher margin, they're able to keep their customers, and their customers truly appreciate it. You know, I can't, you know, when I talk to business owners, you know, price is always a sensitive subject, but, you know, if the price goes up and they don't have to worry about, you know, significant risk around phishing and ransomware and these other things that are keeping a lot of business owners up at night, they're more than happy to pay for the service as long as the partner is competent and credible. So I think that's really, really important. And one partner in a call a few weeks ago from Australia actually tell me they had, you know, they had been selling a variety of Microsoft 365 packages, basic, standard, premium, and a little bit of E3. And they actually made the decision internally to only support business premium or higher. So that means business premium, E3, E5. And the reason they made that decision is customers without security features, without security management, were also the customers that were costing them, you know, the most heartache internally with ops time and tickets and problems. So they told other customers they were going to raise their prices. Business premium was the minimum Microsoft suite they would support, and they expected to lose half their customers, honestly. What was super interesting is they didn't lose one. They were good at what they did. No one was particularly appreciative of a price increase, but when that price increase for their service came with the additional security and competent management of those security features, they were able to retain every single one of their customers. And then the number of problems they had to go solve for also went down. So reducing their operational expenses actually increased profitability, you know, in addition to the top line they received from more expensive services.
I 100% agree with you. I think the focus is about providing value. How do you provide value in the security space? I don't think it's that difficult, but there is some messaging and there is some understanding of what the value is to a customer. And typically, you've got to convert it to dollars, not to speeds and feeds. So you can say, look, a phishing attack is on average going to potentially impact your business like this and mean downtime. And customers have insurance for their cars, their houses, their businesses, their employees. So again, it's a matter of putting it in terms they understand. And as long as there's value in the service, the customer basically will, see that, and I think will take it up. And those that don't, like I said, are typically going to be the ones who are going to cause more pain and probably aren't necessarily the most aligned customers that you could have. So I think, you know, that sort of strategy, rather than trying to do everything and cover everything, is, you know, a much better approach. And the other secret, I think, is to put it in terms of value to help the customer understand what the impact would be and look at it as sort of, you know, an insurance policy. I think also, too, that one of the things that resellers overlook is the reality is a lot of this can be implemented in an automated or repetitive manner using scripts and so on. I think that's one of the big benefits of an integrated Microsoft environment, all these products linked together, and they can be pretty much implemented and set up and configured using something like PowerShell. So in your experience, are you seeing, you know, the partners that are doing this, are they doing it manually or have they made that leap to actually deploying it in an automated and consistent manner using scripts?
So I see most partners getting started with the products manually. They're you know, testing in a sandbox, maybe their first few customers. But, you know, folks who manage, you know, more than just a handful of tenants typically start moving to scripts, one, because as you mentioned, it's easier to standardize. Number two, there's ample resources out there that actually allow, kind of configuration as code. In fact, at Microsoft, we have an open source project on GitHub. I believe it's called the DSC, desired configuration state. I'll have to find the link for you. But we have a open source project that allows you to, you know, manage most of an Office 365/M365 tenant as code, meaning you specify the parameters that you want to be standard, and you can new tenants over and over and again. You can also identify when a tenant drifts out of your desired configuration state. It's really, really cool. In addition to that, we have, you know, a massive library that shows how to take care of, you know, most tasks in Intune with PowerShell. I find that really, really handy. It's also on GitHub. And then lastly, we have things like security baselines, which, to be fair, are a little bit more enterprise leaning, but, you know, they're certainly consumable in an SMB space. Typically, the folks that use the security baselines we have published for enterprise just simplify and modify it to suit their customers' needs. But once that template is done, they can reuse it and quickly get customers either configured correctly or reconfigured correctly without a bunch of work and minimizing the number of mistakes a technician might make if they were, manually configuring stuff in the GUI.
So again, I agree with you. I will call out a couple here that I would recommend. So there's an Office 365 investigation toolkit, obviously, to grab logs and things like that. There's the ability to do it around MFA as well. And there's also now the new capabilities to script the conditional access as well, which is fantastic. That was great to see that finally drop and become available. So leveraging these scripts is the way to go. And I think this goes back to this learning concept of the investment in these core technologies like PowerShell to allow you to scale and to do this in the environment. Because again, things like PowerShell will work across Microsoft Cloud App Security, will work across the conditional access, Intune, all of that. So you're not going to lose out by doing that. And that also gives the reseller the unique IP or their unique selling point, I think, when it compared to everybody else in the market there. So there's a lot of benefit in investing in that because it can be used, obviously, for many, many things. We want that consistency. We want that repeatability in the security space to make sure that we are doing that. So obviously there's a case for setting things up correctly and doing things to a framework and doing what you say there. But sort of what would you suggest to people beyond that? What's the opportunity in things like reporting and ongoing management? I mean, there's obviously a bulk to set up initially, but what's the trailing opportunity once you've done everything right up front from your point of view?
So where I see the opportunity is not only to set things up, but sell your service as the partner as a service. The typical example I like to recommend is a complete offering that includes security from the partner. It'll often include the core productivity and security of Microsoft 365 Business Premium. So in the US, that's $20 to the customer. The partner makes a little bit of margin on that. I also recommend at least having the partner consider something like Microsoft Defender ATP to mitigate targeted attacks. That's an add-on that most people consider. And then the service on top of that. So what I typically see partners in the US and Australia is not too far from this, is selling the complete package with M365, perhaps a few add-ons for around $40 to $50 a month. It makes it unique. It makes it very capable. I often like to see things like, automated phishing campaigns rolled in there. Threat investigation, software such as Huntress or something like that in there. And adding these additional services are usually not at a they don't come with a very high cost to the partner, but it makes it allows them to make a nice, robust, credible service that maps to a framework that they can sell. It's unique. It makes it very, it makes it so customers will want to stick around. It makes it very difficult for them to be price shopped as well.
Yeah, so I think that, again, one of the things that many people who are in the IT support game feel that there isn't this ongoing service around security that you've mentioned here. And I agree with you. I think that there certainly is. Obviously, it has to be mapped out, but there's going to be a constantly changing landscape. There's going to be new devices, new users. There's going to be the need to monitor, the phishing campaigns and that, and to help the customer stay protected. And done correctly and provided in a way that provides value to the customer, they'll be happy to pay that because it gives them peace of mind. And then on the other side of the coin, if that's done in an intelligent, automated way in the back end, I think that really gives you that profitability around that. And I really don't see a lot of partners distinguishing themselves by offering that as a service. It sort of tends to be an afterthought, yes, we do cybersecurity. I mean, you probably got more exposure to this, but is the trend for more people to begin to focus on this as a real, serious offering rather than just an afterthought?
Well, it's my recommendation. I think, you know, there's quite a bit of variance out there in the market depending on both the customer and the partner's maturity. So the partners that have more maturity in this space, that have been doing it for a while, tend to typically have everything rolled up into a nice tidy service that you know, they're confident in, their sales force is confident in, they can represent it correctly or represent it well, and customers are attracted to it. On the other end of the spectrum, I see, you know, partners that may have not been doing security for a while, they don't necessarily have all of that maturity, but they're getting started. You know, and for them, you know, the path may not be, you know, a full managed service right away, but they absolutely can get started with service work or service offerings and project work that help the customers in the areas that are most critical. You know, namely, you know, when I talk to partners like that, my very first recommendation is to make sure they have a full handle on identity security, which, you know, is centralized around MFA, conditional access, features like that. Just make sure that the folks, you know, accessing your customer's tenant are actually who they say they are, and you have high confidence that only the folks that are supposed to be getting in are getting in. You know, and then kind of expanding into and getting started with the wizards we have for Intune, and, you know, they don't necessarily have to start with a fully managed service, but these services are a great on-ramp into getting into the managed services side of the business.
Okay, so it is something that people can get into. They need to obviously make the investment and, you know, deal with it seriously and invest, you know, and understand the services down at a lower level, and some of the best practices Microsoft's got out there make that much, much easier. How do you see that, you know, partners who are progressive and partners who maybe are starting in their journey, are they sharing that information amongst them, or do they tend to try and, you know, keep that information unique to them, afraid that someone else would steal their secret sauce? Do you see this sharing of, you know, security best practices for, you know, people supporting SMB customers?
So the partners that I work with that seem to me to have the most knowledge and best capabilities are also ones that share the most. You know, I can give you an example. You know, Alex Fields from IT Pro Mentor or in Success Computing, you know, has a blog, and he basically blogs about everything that he does for the company and his thoughts and ideas, because he has a lot of, you know, the company has a lot of confidence that, you know, they are not diminished by sharing their knowledge and IP. In fact, it makes them stronger. And I agree with that. You know, in my career, I've learned more attempting to be a teacher and a mentor than I've ever learned, you know, by trying to, you know, hoard knowledge or something like that. So I don't know if that's universally true, but I do believe, you know, the folks that are really, really good at this stuff are happy to share their knowledge. It's for the common good, and they really have nothing to worry about, because, you know, customers that have competent partners tend to stick with competent partners. You know, I rarely see folks being price shopped who are good at what they do.
So would you suggest for somebody who's starting out and maybe a bit unsure in this, is it worthwhile them trying to, you know, look for some sort of mentor relationship or speak to a company who may be doing this successfully and, you know, perhaps get some information, not obviously trying to steal their information, but again, avoid some of the pitfalls and, you know, the where some good resources and that sort of thing? Is that, you know, a recommendation that you would have apart from obviously all the Microsoft documentation and training? Is it, you know, you're going to get the best bang for your buck, do you think, by finding someone who's going to be able to give you that sort of guidance?
Absolutely. You know, I think our documentation, you know, is a wonderful resource, right? But it's not the same as having a conversation with someone in the business. I find trade industries, user groups are extremely valuable. I think that's why we're having this podcast today. You know, there's tons of resources out there, tons of people who want to help. And I when I look across the professionals in the IT and security industry, you know, most of us are really, really tired of hearing about customers having, you know, these calamities, security breaches, ransomware issues. And most of us are like, oh, if only we could have, you know, gotten to them sooner or helped. So I think you'll find more help out there than not. You know, to be honest, I can't think of a single example where I've seen, you know, someone who's good at what they do in this industry, you know, with withholding information or keeping it to themselves. That doesn't necessarily mean everybody shares all of their IP, internal IP, but intellectual property is usually very specific to a customer, you know, a company's means and methods. You know, for example, even Microsoft internal IP, it's not always shared, not because we're trying to hoard it. It's more that it's not terribly useful to someone outside of Microsoft. So it's actually what we tend to do is take IP we think would be useful and translate it and make it more useful for other folks so they don't have to, you know, wade through a bunch of unnecessary internal stuff that doesn't add value to, you know, what they would be doing.
I agree with you. I think there is enough people out there, the vast majority of people are willing to share. Obviously, it's a two-way relationship and you shouldn't impose on other people, but I think there are plenty of people out there who are willing to share both, you know, on the web or face-to-face or remote meetings or whatever. And I think in the security space, if you are unsure, it's always good to get a second opinion from someone else who may not have the same legacy thinking that you have. Is, does this seem right? Am I missing something? I think that's a big benefit to leverage peers to do that. So as we get towards the end of this podcast, our time with Dave, can you just give us, you know, some glimpse into the future as to what Microsoft is thinking about bringing security-wise to the Microsoft 365 Business Premium product as a focus? I will say that many people, myself included, are super excited with the Defender stuff that you are beginning to are going to start rolling into the console, so we can look at the endpoints and manage those and see their signature levels, any issues out there. But what sort of down the path, and again, in just general terms is fine, what can we expect to see security-wise coming into what already is a fantastic product being Business Premium?
One of our biggest areas of focus right now is in multi-tenant management. So you're going to see, you know, us drop a lot of new capabilities for partners who are managing multiple customers. And part of that, you know, the Defender example you just mentioned, you know, I think, you know, as a pure next-gen AV product, Defender does a great job in Windows 10. We've made, you know, enormous progress since Windows XP. But we don't necessarily do a great job of telling the customer, you know, what we blocked, and certainly don't do a good job of telling the partner what we've done across multiple tenants. So look for that. There's private previews going on right now. Public previews are coming out, where you'll be able to do more across multiple tenants. I think you're also going to see, or you should be seeing, you know, significant investments in more of our advanced endpoint protection that goes way beyond antivirus, into the EDR space and endpoint DLP space. This is a big focus of ours, and I think you'll see, you know, continued investment in the email protection area, you know, blocking spam, viruses, and phishing, and using our AI capabilities to try to give customers the edge when staying on top of, you know, all the typical malicious things that are going to come their way.
All right, so just to let you know that the multi-tenant product is called Office 365 Lighthouse. If you want to go out and have a look at that, I'll put the link in the show notes so people can refer to that. I think it's currently in preview at the moment. You can sign up to be included potentially in the preview, but recommend that. We should see that roll out. So what I'll get David to do is just, you know, maybe give us an overview, a summary, some takeaways, you know, what people should be looking at, where the best Microsoft resources, and then share with everybody his contact details. But before I do that, I will give David two requests from the community that I work with. One of the first things many people would like to see is, maybe not the full version, but a more comprehensive version of Microsoft Cloud App Security brought to Business Premium. Obviously, the Cloud App Discovery stuff is great, but the full Cloud App Security would be fantastic as an inclusion with the SKU. And the other one, which again may be a bit more difficult to sort of work out to implement, but I think it could be done, is the ability to also include something like Azure Sentinel, so that all those signals can be fed into a single dashboard with all the machine learning and intelligence and analytics, as well as the ability to go and do active hunting as well. So they'd be the two takeaways I'll ask as a request from my side of the fence. But David, if you can give us a bit of a summary there, and then, you know, where you would point people to as good starting places for what Microsoft has available for particularly Microsoft 365 Business Premium, and then any contact details so that people can follow up with you if they do have any more questions about what you've discussed today.
Sure. And I did want to address your two points. I think they're very well made. I'm also in full agreement that Cloud App Security is a great add-on to M365 Business Premium. In fact, many of the partners I work for or work with added on. So on one side, it is just a couple bucks. On the other side, I totally agree. It'd be really nice if we could get that included. The Sentinel piece is also super interesting. That is actually one I think we should and will go ask for. So, I can't promise anything, but I'm going to advocate for that for sure.
So just a quick throw in on that from my point is it is cheap to implement anyway. It's only a couple of bucks a month to implement, so it's not a big cost. So again, if you're thinking about it, certainly get into it. It's not a big cost, but if it was rolled into the package as an inclusion, I think it would make another great value item.
Yep, 100%. So a couple of things I wanted to point folks out to is Alex from IT Pro Mentor and I just did a CIS blog for M365. You can have a look at that at aka.ms/CIS4M365. We previously put together a nice remote work from anywhere that covers most of the things partners and customers should be looking at when enabling people for remote work. But this list is also applicable for non-remote work situations, and that is at aka.ms/SMB checklist. And lastly, to stay in touch, to ask me questions, to make recommendations, get advice on this or anything else related to M365 Business Premium, we have an SMB tech community. It's at aka.ms/SMBTC. This is where I recommend if anyone has a particularly tough issue question, they need some help with the PowerShell or configuring something, post your questions there. I can't guarantee a same day response, but I can guarantee a thorough and well reasons response. And if if it's something that requires a lot of research or help, we'll do our level best.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'll take the opportunity to thank David very much for his time. I know it's obviously a busy time there, and it's great the information that he shared. I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes so that you can follow up on that. And again, take the opportunity to thank David for his time. And with that, I will call an end to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Microsoft 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selections available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.